The new book, End Zone, The Rise, Fall, and Return of Michigan Football, tells the story of how college football's most successful, richest, and respected program almost lost all three in less than a decade, and entirely of its own doing. It is a story of hubris and greed and betrayal, a tale more suited to Wall Street than the world's top public university. Sports journalist John Bacon explores what happened and why, with countless eye-opening, head-shaking scenes of conflict and conquest. But End Zone is also an inspiring story of redemption and revival. And it's a great pleasure to welcome John Bacon to the roundtable this morning. John, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe.
What was it about this team, it's, as the subtitle says, The Rise, the Fall, and the Return, that you were interested in and wanted to write about?
Oh, sure. First of all, to explain that the return is not, I'm not dumb enough, Joe, to predict Big Ten titles or anything else anytime soon for Michigan. But the return is referring to how the students, the faculty, the lettermen, the alumni, all kind of got together in a grassroots manner and kind of faced what was wrong with Michigan athletics before the NCAA came in, before, you know, investigations and all the rest and things start crumbling. And we're able to correct the department, if you will, in time to land Jim Harbaugh, just in time, in fact. So the return here is an internal one, not an external one.
So what did you find fascinating? Was it how big it was and how big the fall was?
What I found fascinating, really, is how the athletic department at Michigan and probably a lot of big state schools creates a great prism, not prison, and your listeners, Joe, will get that, into how the whole university works. So I looked at the whole department, how it functions with the university, from the players all the way to President Schlissel, who used to be the provost at Brown, and how it works, how the tensions happen, how the politics go on behind the scenes, who's got what power over what, how much can an AD do, when do the regions step up and object. All this stuff to me is fascinating, and you can see how Michigan got into this trouble with the department with an $8 million deficit and out-of-control spending and egos and whatnot, and you also see how they got out of the trouble.
What is fascinating, before we talk about the fall, let us talk about the rise and where they were when they were at the top. This is a huge program. They're the biggest stadium in North America. They had a lot of money, $8 billion in endowment. They had pretty much everything going for them. What got them to that point?
What got them to that point is, I would say, some hardcore Midwestern values, hard work, teamwork. I like to think as a Michigan alum, I grant you integrity and a fierce loyalty and devotion to Michigan. If you, as they say, you can tell a Michigan man, but you can't tell much. So I think the pride in the university is extensive. As you said, $8 billion endowment. That comes from very proud alums, both big rollers and a lot of small rollers. So that, I think, is how they got there. The flip side, almost any successful organization is, with that naturally comes a certain degree of arrogance and hubris, and when you go too far with it, that's what happens next, and that's what started doing them in.
When can you see signs of that, of where there started to be cracks?
For me, a few things. One, from 1990 on, when Bo Schembechler, the old legendary coach who became the AD for a couple of years, when he steps down, as Don Canham, his predecessor, said, it never changed until Bo left from 1898 to 1990, and then it seemed to change overnight. And after that, you had five ADs for 90 years, averaging 18 years each. Since then, you've had seven ADs for 25 years, averaging about 3.5 years each. So that's a problem right there, of course. And not one since Bo has had 1 hour of experience in an athletic department before taking the job. You wouldn't do that at the law school. You wouldn't do that at the med school. You wouldn't do that at the business school, obviously. But for some reason, the hubris is that we can put a smart guy into this role and nothing's going to go wrong. And that's just not the case.
When, and you read about this, and I think it's funny because the obviously this book is very much about football and about that program. But how linked they are of the university and the athletic program. So they're sort of both in on it of the cracks, right, of what caused it to collapse in such an epic way.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And at Michigan, like, you know, most Big Ten schools or SEC schools or Big 12. You wouldn't find this out east except for, you know, Rutgers and Penn State, I suppose, that it is so dependent in some ways on athletics for its profile, for its community building aspects. Almost all the guys who are writing big checks have got great feelings about Michigan, and a lot of those happen on football Saturdays. So that's how it's all kind of driven in the same direction, I think. The key there also, of course, is to make sure the horse comes before the cart. And when Dave Brandon was named AD in 2010, this is where things get really off the rails, in my opinion, that he had no experience, again, like the other ADs before him and as an AD. But President Coleman, who thought very highly of Dave Brandon, she's, basically wanted him to be the AD. And one of the regents said, if you want him to be the AD, just appoint him. She said, no, we got to have a search committee to make it, look good and so on. Well, the search committee comes back repeatedly saying he is the one guy who's not qualified. We got three highly qualified candidates on this list. He's not one of them. And it basically comes back, well, think again. So when you start superseding your own processes in place as safety guards, safety nets, when those are pulled away, you get more and more hubris and an out-of-control executive.
And it seems, in reading the book, there was also a certain degree of panic, too.
Panic? What a combination, right?
Stir, mix, and enjoy.
Arrogance, ignorance, and panic. What can go wrong, right, Joe?
Right.
There was at the end, when things started going off the rails and it becomes public, you can see it privately behind the scenes from the sources, as you've already read, layer by layer. But it finally starts getting public around 2013, 2014. And when it finally hits in 2014 with Michigan quarterback Shane Morris suffering what they finally diagnosed was a probable mild concussion. They're all serious, obviously, but that's relatively tame. He went out for dinner with his parents that night. But they got put back in the game inadvertently through a lack of communication and so on. It became a big national story, and now the panic is really in. And you've, again, it's kind of like Hurricane Katrina. It was obviously a historic hurricane in 2005. But at the Times Picayune said before that, and I know you've covered this, they were saying 5 years earlier, look, man, the levees aren't ready. The inspections aren't good. We're not prepared for this. It's going to happen again sooner or later, and it's going to be a disaster. And that's exactly what happened to Michigan football on a minor scale, is safety net after safety net was removed, PR people who knew what they were doing, lettermen who were close to the organization, faculty oversight, all these things were taken away layer by layer by layer. And finally, a relatively small incident, like a probable mild concussion, which is a friend of mine said, you know what that is? It's a headache. But it looked really bad in a PR point of view, and now you're into a media vortex for a week. I was on Al Jazeera talking about this on national TV, of course. It was after a piece on ISIS and Ebola and then Michigan football. Not exactly the kind of company you want to be keeping during that stage, and that's what happened due finally to the panic, as you point out.
About halfway in the book, there's a chapter called The Students Fight Back, and I found this to be a really interesting part of the story because the students really have a large role in this.
Yeah, and that was, to me, one of the coolest parts of the story is a couple 21-year-old kids, the student government president and vice president, Michael Proppy and Bobby Dischel. What happened with the students was that out of nowhere, Dave Brandon, the AD, decides to pull the decades-old program of reserved seating for the students, which means historically you start as a freshman in the end zone of Michigan Stadium, and by your senior year you're sitting around the 35-yard line and life is pretty good. It's a rite of passage, some would say a birthright, a bit entitled perhaps, but that's how it's been working for years, without any notice, any warning, any consultation with the students or the government leaders. Overnight they say this is the new policy, general admission, first come, first serve. So a freshman who wakes up a half an hour before a senior, he'll be sitting front row in the 30-yard line. So as you might imagine, the students went ballistic over this, and the student government leaders took it as their charge, basically, to defend this, to attack this. And they did so using, God bless them, their Michigan educations in the Ford School of Public Policy and stats in the business school. And they basically ran circles around the marketing guys in the department, twice their age, in faculty meetings, regent meetings, and so on, because they knew how to analyze data in a real way with differentials and whatnot, and the marketing guys didn't. And they proved that not only was general admission deeply unpopular with the student body, with 80% saying they hated it, It was also ineffective at getting them there on time or getting them there to the games at all, which were the problems that Dave Brandon was trying to solve. So at that point, they say, we have demonstrated to you that no one likes it and it doesn't work, so why do we have it? And a victory for a 21-year-old kid going against a 45-year-old guy with, you know, marketing background from the New York Knicks, that to me was a great David and Goliath story.
In writing about Jim Harbaugh, why was he such a catch for the university? I mean, it seems as though that you say, okay, this is the guy who can save us.
That's right, and no doubt his status. He was obviously, of course, a great coach at Stanford. He had taken a 1-11 team and gotten them to the Orange Bowl champion. They won the Orange Bowl a few years later. He'd taken over a moribund NFL team in San Francisco, the 49ers, that had won four or five games the year before, got him to the Super Bowl in his first year. It's a really a great run there, of course. So this guy's one of the hottest coaches, NFL or college, in the country. He also happens to be a kid who grew up in Ann Arbor, who, of course, played at Michigan. His dad was a coach at Michigan, assistant coach. And, you know, if he went to the Chicago Bears or the New York Jets or the Raiders, he would be a very good coach. If he went back to Ann Arbor, he would be greeted as a savior, and he certainly has been, because a lot of good coaches could have come back to Michigan and done a good job, but only one guy would make Michigan fans feel immediately relevant, like they mattered, when this guy blew off more money, no doubt, more prestige, more fame in the NFL to come back to his alma mater and coach his old team. So overnight, the Michigan football family had been unified by one guy.
And what went into getting him was really fascinating. I mean, because it was a lot of Michigan alum, a lot of huge names, a lot of work in the phones to make the catch.
Yeah, man, it's a pretty cool story there. The old Hillary Clinton line, it takes a village. It turns out, Joe, it also applies to recruiting a hotshot coach. They did not just rely on the AD, because the AD, Dave Brandon, back in 2011, failed to get Harbaugh before he took over the Niners job. So this time, the Letterman, the fans, and so on were not going to leave it up to the AD alone. So a group of Lettermen who'd played with Jim Harbaugh in the 80s got a calling circle together of about three dozen former Michigan players, guys that Jim grew up admiring when he was a ball boy for the team in the 70s, guys he played with in the 80s, and, of course, the big stars like Charles Woodson, and, yes, even Tom Brady in your backyard right there, of course, in Boston. And how do you get Tom Brady to call Jim Harbaugh? It's not through his PR guy or his publicist or the Patriots themselves. You get Tom Brady to call Jim Harbaugh through a 43-year-old dishwasher in Ann Arbor at Pizza House called Jay Flannelly, who used to be a student manager in the team 20 years ago and is still one of Tom Brady's closest friends. So he calls up Brady after they beat San Diego in San Diego and says, man, you got to call Jim Harbaugh. Here's his number. And Brady says right away, that is exactly the guy we need to get back to Michigan. So Brady calls up Jim Harbaugh that night. They talk for an hour or two, apparently. And I cannot tell you, Joe, that's why, of course, Jim Harbaugh came back to Michigan. But if Tom Brady is begging you for an hour or two to come back to coach Michigan, it's got to help.
And but what it does, at very least, is illustrate the importance for alum and students and people in that region of that program.
No question. And look, I mean, again, a lot of good coaches could have come back, but once Harbaugh comes back, he was everyone's first, second, and third choice. And beyond that, you're just trying to match resumes. So he was considered, in fact, the nickname, that the code name that the AD, Jim Hackett, used to try to get Harbaugh in all private communications was the Unicorn, which tells you a lot about Jim's very special status amongst Michigan people.
All right, so you got him. Now what?
Now you got to win some football games, man. That side of the story, Joe, will never change. And I was out there in Utah for the first game, Michigan versus Utah. And Michigan lost, as expected. They're the underdogs. But I can tell you they played a whole lot better than they did last year when Utah put up to them pretty good. So it'll take them 3 or 4 years, I'm sure. And right now, of course, Michigan is in a brutal division with Ohio State, the returning national champs, who looked great over Virginia Tech. You've got Michigan State. And here's a bar bet for you, Joe. The only team in the United States to be in the top five the last 2 years is not Alabama or Florida State or Ohio State. It's Michigan State, rather surprisingly. Mm-hmm. So those are two teams in your division. Penn State is clearly, well, despite the Temple loss, of course, should be on the rise sometime soon. So Jim's got his work cut out for him, but what he's got now is everybody behind him. 5 years at least, I'm sure, and a lot of patience. And I'm very confident Jim Harbaugh will succeed where he has done everywhere else he's been.
The name of the book, End Zone, The Rise, Fall, and Return of Michigan Football. John Bacon, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Joe, always a pleasure.
Nice to have you. Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, End Zone. It's published by St. Martin's Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.